My name is Ann, and I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. Yes, I am. And before anybody gets their knickers in a knot about that word recovered, let me please clarify. I have recovered from the seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. It doesn't mean that I am bulletproof or drink proof. Okay, I have to maintain my spiritual program. Anyway, this is my story. I hope you guys can relate at least a little bit to it. I came from an alcoholic family. I was one of seven children. My mom got married like a bunch of times and had like kids with, you know, many of them. So there was like seven kids and five different fathers, and we had a very colorful family. All of us had different ethnic backgrounds, and I was one of five girls, and my mom used to say that she had the whole United Nations, you know, right there in our house. And so she had Miss England, and I was Miss Sweden, and we had Miss Germany, and we had Miss Mexico. Okay, so that was just the girls, okay? So anyway, that was my family background. My mom was alcoholic, my father was alcoholic, and they actually did get some sobriety around the time I was a baby. And they had a clubhouse near where he was working, which was in Las Vegas, Nevada. And he was there during the early 50s helping to build the hotels over there. And that's how I happened to be born in the middle of the doggone desert, you know, at the only hospital that was there. It was a little bitty hospital for a silver mining town called Henderson. And so I was born out there in the desert. And both of them partied a lot, and that's what they did. You know, he'd work 6 days a week, and then they'd go out, and they would just party crazy. You know, and it was a real fun lifestyle for them. You know, they were all living like rock stars out there. They worked really hard, and then they partied really hard. So that was my background. And my mom went on to marry a few more alcoholics along the way. But anyway, my brother and I, we both had the same dad. And we kind of laugh about that, you know. That's kind of, you know, there was two of us that were pairs, you know, a sister and brother there and a sister and brother there that was from the same dad. And anyway, that was my background. Now, she didn't stay sober. A little bit later on down the road, toward the end of her life, she went out and started drinking again. My father, though, lived sober for about the last 7 or 8 years of his life. And he passed away in the mid-80s. But my mom went off the wagon and started going downhill pretty fast. And she subsequently went insane and died at the age of 52. And so I was only 17 years old at the time. And so this left a real big impression on me. You know, I saw her at the very end of her disease, and she looked really bad, and it looked really sad. And, you know, here I am, a preteen, and I'm watching this, and I'm going, I don't know why these adults do this drinking stuff. Oh my God. You know, I was just real, you know, what do they see in this stuff? Why do they do that? Why do they do that to them? So they're so, they don't make sense, you know. And then we had a lot of excitement in our home, especially around the holidays, you know. And like my mom kicking a Christmas tree across the room, you know. And we're like all by herself in the living room, and we hear this crash, and we run out there, and what the, you know, and she just decided she was, you know, she did Christmas, she put Christmas up, and she was taking it down that night, you know. And that was normal for our home. My stepdad and mom would fight a lot. We'd had the police over the house a lot. You know, the police knew us by first name. You know, they'd show up and they go, okay, what's going on this time, you know. I mean, it's not the kind of childhood that you wanted a whole lot of friends to be in on. So pretty much we stayed to ourselves. We didn't invite kids from outside the family to come inside our house, because, you know, we just never knew what was going to go on and what was going to happen. So, you know, that part of my childhood was not good. And then, of course, her going really getting very sick in the last couple of years, that was not good. I looked at this ship and I said, I'm bailing out of this. I've got to bail out of this quick. So I got married at 17. You know, I got out of there real quick. But before I did, she actually was really going downhill in the last couple of years. She had gotten breast cancer and would not go to the doctors because she didn't trust them. And she was all paranoid by this time. And she basically, you know, she let a lump in her breast go for 5 years. Until the cancer had spread throughout her body. By the time I took her to the hospital, a friend of mine took her to the hospital, it had spread everywhere in her body, and they said, she's not going to live very long. She's just not going to live. There's no treatment we can give her. It's just too far gone. And they said 1 to 3 years. And I'm 17 years old, and I'm going, what? You know, and my two younger sisters were going to have to live with me because, you know, I mean, you talk about growing up quick. And she didn't make it out of the hospital within 3 months. She was gone. But the sad part about that was that I was so angry at her from this crazy life that she had inflicted on us that I couldn't even cry. I couldn't even grieve for her. I mean, I was like relieved. It was kind of like, whew, the craziness stops. It's finally stopping. Little did I know I had a little crazy up in me too, you know. But that came out a little bit later on. The first time I ever had a drink, I think I was probably about 13. And my mom would go to the liquor store, and she was, you know, she'd start off on the really nice gourmet, you know, family winery-owned bottles of wine, and eventually it got to the Gallo bottle jugs. That was before the boxes came out. Anyway, that's exactly, you know, that's where I eventually went to. Well, she was in there buying her gallon of Gallo wine, and she bought a couple of things that were up by the front register, and it was like little brandies or something. And so I saw her get these little bottles, and they were cute. They were like little sample bottles, a couple of different flavors and stuff. So I saw those little bottles, and I decided I was going to try some of those and see how they tasted. And they were very sweet. It was very, very sweet. And so then I came in after I drank both of them, and I walk in, and I said to my mom, I said, Mama, what would happen if somebody drank like two or three of those little bottles all at one time? And they were brandy. I mean, you know, they were pretty high content. She says, well, I don't know anybody stupid enough to drink those all. I said, well, I just did. And then she says, well, you better sit down. You know, you better sit down. And that was the first time that I'd gotten really, really intoxicated. And it was a real fun party of about an hour and a half. You know, I was spinning, the room was spinning, and I felt good, and I had a warm glow, and all that fun, fun stuff. And then I go, oh, now I see what they're talking about. Now I get it, you know. And, of course, after the hour and a half was up, then it was time for bathroom, you know, and clinging to the bowl and all that kind of stuff, because that was some nasty stuff. It was pretty nice going down, but not coming back. And then I realized, you know what? I can't do this. This is terrible. I can't do this at all. Well, you know, after I turned 18, and I'd gotten married to a guy, the first guy that I had met that asked me to marry him that looked like he had a decent job. He was in the Army, and I married him. And then he went back overseas to Germany, and I was living in this place, and they had this, like a little private club type of a thing where people would meet on Friday nights. And even though I was underage, I could go down there and, like, I dressed up really nice and I looked very mature for my, you know, age and everything. Like, I had the false eyelashes out to here and big stacked high heels, and I was a fashion plate and all that kind of stuff. And you're really shocked about that, right? And here I was looking like a big girl in the city, you know, had a job. I had it going on. My life was great. And they gave me alcohol. And so I tried it, and it was a really nasty rum or something. And they said, oh, here, let's pour some Coke in it. It'll taste better. And I said, well, now that's what we're talking about here. And I really liked that because it made me feel not shy and not uncomfortable. And it didn't make, you know, I used to feel less than. I put this big act on to look like I had it all together. And I really didn't. I was really scared. I had no education. I had no experiences. I didn't know anything. And I had no social skills because I didn't have girlfriends. And, you know, I mean, I was just a kid that kind of stayed off away from people in school and like that. And hadn't finished high school. You know, my mother was getting really sick. And I had to stay home and take care of my two sisters. And, you know, so I dropped out of high school so that I could take care of my family. And so I didn't have any social skills. I didn't know how to conduct myself. But boy, I'll tell you, I felt comfortable when I felt that warm buzz go on. And then I said, this is a bit of all right. This is okay. And I mean, I could do anything. I could talk to anybody. I could dance out in public. I could do whatever I wanted to do. And I really liked the feeling. But of course, I wasn't going to drink like my mother did because she was sloppy. You know, she was really sloppy and sick and not having any parts of that. But the way I drank was different, right? That was really totally different. So that's what kind of launched my little career with drinking. And I never got to be a person that drank a lot or daily or anything like that. So I never thought that I had a drinking problem. I never thought that I could even possibly have, you know, an alcoholism problem. I know my mother did. I know she had a weird, she had a wicked problem. My father did. You know, he drove us the wrong side of the freeway with all the kids in the car. You know, he had a problem, but I didn't have a problem. So anyway, fast forwarding, I had a child when I was about 20. And this guy that I married, I really didn't know him that well. We kind of met through a correspondence. So anyway, I knew nothing about romance. I knew nothing about marriage. Where would I see marriage, right? My mother had been married so many times, we couldn't even keep track. And so I didn't know what marriage was supposed to be. I didn't know what any of that was. I was just really didn't know. And so, but I knew that I didn't have it with this guy. This guy was boring, and, you know, he just, it wasn't like the true romance novel was. That one, that was true love right there. That was true love. And I didn't have that with this guy. So, you know, by the time I was about 21, you know, we were both kind of like, we didn't know who we were. He was 7 years older than I was. And boy, did he get a pig in the poke. I mean, he didn't have any idea how immature I was, because how would he know? You know, I wrote a pretty good letter, and my mom wrote most of them for me anyway, so there you go, you know, because she was quite a little writer. And so he was actually, he didn't know that he was corresponding with my mother, but, well, he found out later on, I think, you know, he wasn't too pleased about that. But anyway, so that marriage went to the wayside, and then I wound up being a single mom at 21. And I, you know, and it was my first time, because I'd had the mother that was very controlling, and then I traded off for the husband that was very controlling. So as soon as I got out of that marriage and I was single, well, party on. You know, it's party time, okay? I can party and I can do whatever I want. Plus, I was over 21. Hey, I can even do it legally. And so I was going to school 40 hours a week in cosmetology school, and at night working 30 hours. And, you know, that's a heck of a schedule. I don't even know how I did that. I can't even imagine it. And then when I'd get off work, I had to make up and have some recreation time, of course, you know, so I would drink at night and so forth. And I don't know how I didn't get a DUI or something like that. I mean, it was amazing to me that I didn't get in trouble legally, but I think I just, you know, if you did the math on the hours, I just really wasn't available that much to really get in bad trouble, and I guess I was just lucky. But I got through all of that and moved to Honolulu, Hawaii, and my daughter was 3 by that time, and her dad said that she could stay with him while I got set up and everything, and that sounded like a good deal because it also sounded like I'd have freedom, and I really didn't know what freedom was like, but I was pretty much going hog wild with the freedom and the drinking and anything I wanted to do. And, you know, from being so confined. And, I mean, I was my own person now, you know, whatever that is. And, you know, I was having a heck of a good time. So, you know, I loved the life over in Honolulu. I got over there, and then I didn't have any money to get back because I didn't like it when I first got there. I was scared. I didn't know anybody. Everything was weird. It was real shock, cultural shock, because there's like Asian and this and Polynesian and me. And I'm taller than everybody because they're all like real short. And it was just real weird over there at first. But anyway, eventually I got used to it, and eventually my daughter came over to visit me, because then by that time I'd gotten myself established. I had a good job. I was working in this really nice fancy salon. Oh man, the partying in the salon that we were in. Lots of people, and they had the not only the drinking thing going on. We were serving wine in the evenings, and my boss actually had to say, "The wine is for the customers, not for you." You know, I had my own silver goblet that I drink my wine right along with the customers. From about 6 o'clock on, we were having some wine. And then eventually got my own salon, and we served wine there, surprise, also. So anyway, that was my life at that time. And I didn't think I had a partying problem. you know. And of course, I attracted every partying guy that there possibly could be, possibly. And then my next husband was a partier, surprise. And he was a little bit too much. I mean, he tried some of that solid alcohol, you know, in the snorting and the tablet form. And he did some really wild stuff. And I don't know what I thought that was love, but I think it was, I don't know what that was. That was just excitement of some sort, you know, because he needed me. He needed me. He got bonked on the head and he was acting all crazy. And so I said, oh, it's got to be love. So he needed me. And I got on with him and I had two more kids. That was about 12 years later. And so we were struggling for quite a while. And then I got these kids. And then he had to shift over where he was working. And I was staying home with the kids. And the next thing you know, he's getting off into the partying field. And I'm staying home with these kids. And I'm stuck with these kids. And I can't party no more. And that wasn't going over real good. And eventually, I just got sick and tired of his partying. I couldn't take it anymore. I was staying home. It was no fun. And so anyway, we got divorced. And then I got to party again. I was, because I could do my own thing then. But of course, I wasn't an alcoholic, you know. But while I was going through that divorce, as soon as the words alcohol and drugs comes up, we had to go for, and children were involved, we had to go for evaluation. We go before the court, and the judge says, what's the problem here? And then I said, well, it's him. He does drugs and alcohol, and I just can't take it no more. And then he looks at me, and he says, nope, she does painkillers and blah, 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 and wine or whatever I was, and I just can't. You know, I don't know why she's leaving me. And so the judge looks at both of us and says, I don't know who's telling the truth around here, but both of you are going for evaluation. And I want to tell you, I took that evaluation. I did a really good job of lying, real good. I lied and really diminished stuff and just really stretched the truth a lot. And they still seem to think I had an alcohol problem, even with all that lying I did. And I was good, too. So... So they said, you guys are going to have, you know, with this child custody battle, they said, you know, you're going to have to, you know, because we were fighting over the kids and all of that. And so they said, okay, you're going to have to go to AA or something like that. I said, no, I don't need AA. I mean, I'll go to an Al-Anon. See, because if you go to an Al-Anon, you don't have to stop drinking. Okay? Made sense to me. So I went to Al-Anon, and then we got through the divorce, and I got the kids living with me. And that was around, I was about 38 years old at the time. And at that time, my drinking really started picking up. And I didn't realize how much it was picking up, but it was picking up a lot. And like every weekend. And there was times that I was thinking back, well, shoot, I've not drank for a really long, long period. See, the obsession, the mental obsession about the alcohol, that's part of the disease for me, is the obsession about it. Well, I haven't drank that much, and the last time was this time, blah, blah, blah. And then I look back over when I was doing a fourth step with my sponsor, and I realized, well, no, you didn't do it during that time because you were pregnant, and then you didn't do it during that time because you were on painkillers, and you can't do both at the same time, and you didn't during that time because you were smoking the funny kind weed every day. And so, you know, I thought those were periods of abstinence from alcohol, but I didn't realize that I was doing other stuff too. And so, you know, I really was never, ever without something. I mean, I was always had something. I substituted something. And so between the ages of 38 and 42, my drinking and my disease totally escalated to the point where I was really scaring myself a little bit. You know, I was starting to do things that were really dangerous. And I mean, I'd think about it the next day, and I'd, you know, I'd be coming back, you know, in Hawaii. I would be going around the island. Like, I used to like to go to the officers club, which is on the other side of the island, on the windward side, and I would drive around these hairpin curves like this all the way around, ocean dropping straight down, you know, there on one side, and mountain this side. And you know, and I'm doing this completely lit, you know, whoop, you know, just like that. I don't know how I lived through that. I don't know how, just the grace of God, I guess. And, you know, it was crazy. It was really, really crazy. And, you know, and of course, one alcoholic messed up boyfriend after the other. I mean, I just almost had a revolving door for him, you know. And, you know, all of this drama constantly in my life. Drama, 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 drama. I always had these problems. If only this wasn't happening, that wasn't happening. Oh, when is this going to... My sister used to do astrology, and I'd call her up. What in the world is in the stars now? Okay, I mean, they're really up my butt. These, you know, what's going on now? And she was, of course, crocked on the other side, and she's telling me, you know, well, this one and Neptune and Uranus and da-da-da-da, and it's going over this house and that. And I'm going, well, when's it stop, you know? But, you know... It never stopped, okay? It was just always something, okay? Then I got into this self-awareness and, you know, well, I just want to get away from this negativity, and I've got to just be positive thinking. That's it. I've just got to do positive thinking because then I'll get rid of all of these negative situations in my life. And so I read all these self-help books and going to all of these, you know, business little seminars and stuff like that, and, you know, sales motivational speakers and all this stuff to try to keep myself pumped up, because I would be always going like this, up and down and up and down and up and down. And of course, all the drama going on in my life, that didn't help either. And, you know, if those stars would just straighten out, you know, for a long period of time so I can catch my breath. And so, I mean, after about 4 years of drinking alcoholically, I mean, my bottom came up on me. And the problem here is this. At the time of that divorce, I got into Al-Anon. And then I was the Al-Anon watching the alcoholic in me. It was like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and one of them's watching the other one, and it was like paranoia. You know, and, well, how much am I drinking? Well, I'm not drinking that much. Well, when's the last time? And I'm having this, it's like your own nagging mother in your head. And, you know, so then I would go to the Al-Anon meetings and stuff, and the alcoholic was always the bad guy. You know, it was always those alcoholics, and you try to figure out a way to be, you know, serene around them, whether they're drinking or not. We prefer they not. And so anyway, I'd had about six years or something like that. My sponsor was in both programs. She was in Al-Anon and she was also in AA. And when I finally got around to, I didn't want to rush into things. So about 6 years into the program of Al-Anon, I did my fourth step with her. And she basically had it just like track me down to my house and make me do these steps. So I finally got them done. And we sit down and we do the fifth step in Zippy's Restaurant. I remember that. It's a big chain in Hawaii. Everything's orange, bright orange. And we're in Zippy's, and I did my fifth step. And one of the things I had listed was, I think I might be alcoholic. And she just kind of like let it go. She didn't say a thing about it. And when we were ready to start taking that up, you know, along about 9, we'll look at that then. But by that time, I'd had just one more dramatic, another alcoholic husband kind of fell into the picture real quick. That one was like, I told her, that one really doesn't count. That's like half a marriage. And she says, no, even though it's short, it was a whole marriage. It was a whole divorce, wasn't it? Yes, it was. Okay. So three months. That was 3 months, right? Well, and you have to understand my logic in picking this guy and marrying him. You see, I owned my own salon, and I had all this responsibility. I had all these people counting on me, and I was the boss, and I had to write the checks and blah 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 blah, and work. And of course, I had to drink to keep up with the work. But anyway, I had all this responsibility, and I went out one night, and the kids would be every other weekend with their dad. So on the weekends that they were gone, that was when I would party down. And then on the weekends that I had the kids, well, not so much. And we'd stay home and everything like that. But on the weekends they were gone. So I went out to some kind of a show or a live play, or I think it was Jesus Christ Superstar or something like that. Anyway, and I was down in wherever this was, in Kahala, I think it was. And so then I decided to drop in to this little bar in Kahala afterward, and I was all dressed up to the nines. I mean, you can stretch your imagination, but I had like a full beaded sparkly jacket on and silk and everything like that. And I mean, I looked like I was going to like the Emmys or something, and you know, nobody else dressed that way, but I did. But then I was a salon owner, and you know how they are. And this guy comes, and two guys were kind of like fighting over trying to get my attention and stuff like that. And the one that was the most persistent, I think, was the one that I let go home with me because I couldn't drive. And of course, I didn't know he was completely ripped too, but I thought, if we get pulled over, it's him that's going to jail, not me, right? So what am I doing getting into the car with somebody I don't even know, letting him drive me to my house because I thought it was safer? That is alcoholic thinking, right? That is, right? Can anybody relate to that? That's alcoholic thinking. So it's like, I'm not going to drive, it's my car, okay, and we're going to my house. God knows who this guy is. I'd never met him before, you know. He spends the night. I wake up sick as a dog the next day, and he jumps up and he says, I know what I've got for that. And he whips me up some kind of ramen Simon noodle thing with egg in it, this and that. It was really disgusting, but he says, it'll take care of that hangover. And you know, he was right. It really did take care of that hangover. He seemed like he knew what he was doing, you know. Plus, he was a nice guy because he didn't try no moves on me. Of course, I was all passed out. I don't know if he did or not. But all my clothes were still on the next day, so I figured he didn't, you know. So anyway, and he was so nice. He says, well, geez, what's going on around here? You got all these boxes and this, that. I said, yeah, I'm having a move and everything like that. And he says, well, I could help you with that. And I said, you can? I mean, somebody offering to help you move? You got to marry him, right? Right? He fixed things. He was good with a hammer and a screwdriver, and he fixed things. Then he went and cooked for me and my kids. He's definitely good material. So, month later, you know, and I had a girlfriend I was sitting down with, and she was my best girlfriend in Hawaii, Adrian. She, you know, I was Alan, and I was the one that was driving her around, and she was married to a cop, and she didn't want to get a DUI, so I wouldn't drink those nights, and we'd go out together. And it got to the point where we were having screaming matches on the phone, and I finally told her in my best black belt Al-Anon voice, I said, Adrian, I do not want to put up with protecting your drinking any longer. I don't like you as a friend, and I don't want to be your friend as long as you're drinking. Click. We used to hang up on each other all the time. It was like who could hang up first on each other. We'd like to do that, you know. And finally, so you know what she did? She freaking got sober. She went and got sober on me. What a pain in the butt then she was. Calling me up, telling me about being sober. And I'm saving a chair for you, and I'm saying, you're so codependent, you can't even go to those stupid AA meetings by yourself, okay? I know your number, baby. So anyway, after about a year, she actually turned out to be kind of nice. And I kind of really liked, you know, how she turned out. And I didn't trust it very much because I thought it could all go at any time. But, you know, I still had some resentments to her, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But her mother passed away, and so I went to her and did a little speaking about her mother because her mother was a friend of mine too. And then, you know, we slowly started getting our friendship back together, and we didn't have those screaming matches and the hanging up on the phone and all that kind of stuff. Well, anyway, so here she is. She's planting those little seeds, you know, those little seeds, you know, like, you know, well, you could always try not drinking for 30 days. And, you know, whenever she'd hear any of my little drinking woes, you could always, like, you know, start drinking and then just stop. What? What is the point of that? I can stop anytime I want to. I just don't want to. Sound familiar? So anyway, so she's over there, and she's still my best friend. I mean, she's hung with me through all of this stuff, and, you know, when my bottom was starting to come up. Okay, the marriage to that guy that I married, like, a month after I met him. Well, after I let him pick me up and take me to my house. Oh, God, that was embarrassing. And I finally had to get rid of him with a restraining order and a locksmith. Okay, we finally got rid of him that way because he was crazy. He was like drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning. He was drunk at 9 o'clock. He was a waiter, and he drank at night, and then he'd get up in the morning, start popping beers, and then would kind of like cruise all the way through the day at about 4 o'clock, take a shower, go on work. He was like round-the-clock drinker. And my friend Adrian said, you do know that he's an alcoholic, don't you? I said, oh, sure I do, but I can handle it. That was really wise. So we got married, and his parent, he'd never been married before, and his parents tried to just like buy us off by giving us some hush money and go off to Las Vegas and let's not make a big deal out of this thing. So he turned around and bought me a big old fat ring with it, and we had a big knockdown and drag out wedding at my church in the middle of Ainahia, a few blocks down from where his parents lived, and you know, made a big deal out of it. And but they knew that this didn't look like it was going to. First of all, he was like 12 years younger than me, you know, and his fishing buddies, he was like a body surfer and you know, all that kind of stuff. And his fishing buddies said, oh, so she's marrying her houseboy, huh? What? Those people don't understand love. This is true love. So anyway, so funny. So I thought he was going to help me like he did when he was trying to get me. And so, you know, I'd get up in the morning, I'd say, well, I'd really like you to drop off some things over to the dry cleaners, and, you know, it's like 9 o'clock in the morning. And he's like, I really wished you would have told me a little sooner. And I said, sooner? It's like 9 o'clock in the morning. He says, yeah, I've already drank about 5 beers. I don't really want to go do that. And I said, what? You know, and so obviously I wasn't as able to handle it as I thought I was. And then some other things happened too, like he would get kind of violent and crazy, just talk crazy talk, and you know, threaten my son-in-law with a knife, and I mean, it was just pretty crazy. After about a couple of months of that, I had about enough of that, and so I had to get him out the door, and so and pay for the divorce too, and you know, give him his Israel Kamaka Viva Ole CD back, and all that kind of stuff. That was our big marriage settlement, you know, was that it was autographed by Izzy. And okay, so I got rid of him and I get on down the road, but now I'm starting to think, maybe my drinking is a problem. Maybe it is. You know, I did that 4-step and I wrote it out. And I got thinking about it because I thought, oh, this last little go-round just really wasn't all that sane, was it? It was pretty crazy. And when your 8-year-old daughter comes to you and says, Mom, maybe I ought to get to know more than 4 weeks before you get married, okay? Boom! Ever had a kid side smack you like that, you know? And it was the truth, so of course, you know. And I thought, oh, that was kind of crazy. And so when that came out, by that time, I mean, my business was just going, it was so chaos. I mean, and I was just, my disease was coming up and I was getting crazier all the time. The people that worked for me in this salon, they didn't like all of this craziness that was going on. They just didn't have you couldn't hang, you know, they just couldn't hang. So some girls decided to go and pack up and grab all of my people and go start another salon over in the same little community, which left me with a great big salon, nobody in there to work it, and no money coming in, which basically meant that I was going to have to do something, you know. So I had about filed bankruptcy. That just broke my heart. I mean, I lost my business. I lost another marriage. You know, God knows what I've been putting my kids through. I wound up having to go to the church that I went to get food and get some help and get financial, you know, and a place to live. And I bailed out of this beautiful townhouse apartment that I had, and it had gorgeous furniture and all this kind of stuff that was really nice, a 60-inch TV and the whole deal. Moved into a little tiny one-bedroom place that was in a cracked neighborhood. And you know, just my brand new car, had to give it back, get old piece of junk. and, you know, moved myself, my two kids, and they were sleeping on the floor in the living room because the place was so small. I had so much stuff that I couldn't fit inside this thing. It was out of my carport, and people raffled through it, just took whatever the hell they wanted. It was that kind of neighborhood, you know. We had a crack, people next door were smoking so much. You could stand on my front door and get high just from what was coming over from them. And then down the street, we had some kind of a women's shelter hideaway place or something. I mean, it was a terrible place. It was a terrible neighborhood. And so anyway, New Year's Eve, I think, Christmas, I think one of my alcoholic boyfriends came in and was supposed to come, and we were going to do something on New Year's Eve. And he stood me up for some reason. I mean, well, he was alcoholic, you know, so of course he stood me up. And so I had this bottle of champagne in my fridge, and I popped it open. We were going to go out in the street and do some sparklers. Whoopee, that's all we could afford, sparklers. And, you know, because the church had to get donations to give my kids Christmas, you know. So, you know, I went from being the illustrious business owner in Hawaii Kai, which is, you know, really nice neighborhood, you know, professionals and everything like that, to living in a crack neighborhood, you know, with the church helping to support me and my two kids. And so I'm out there, and I had one glass of the champagne, and I was looking at the bottle, and I just said, I don't know. I don't know if I can do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. I can't be having any more alcoholic boyfriends. I just had it with that, and husbands, and, you know, my friends had bailed out, and, you know, I mean, my life was really, really, it was the pits. Lost my money, lost my business, lost everything. Except I still had my kids, thank God, but they were sleeping on the floor in the living room. And so the next day I got up and I saw this bottle, and I just took it and I poured it down the drain. And I went to my first meeting on the 3rd of January, and that was in 1995. And that was the last time I took a drink. But what, backing up 1 week on Christmas Day, I'd kind of crossed over a line of something I'd never thought that I would do. And one of the things my mom used to do was take us for rides in the car when she was drinking. And I said I'd never do that. Never. I mean, I'm sure I said I'd never do a lot of other things, but those kind of slipped by. But this one was a biggie for me because I love my kids more than anything. They were the only thing that I really had that I loved. Really, more than myself, more than anything. And I really, really wanted to take good care of them. And on Christmas Day, we had a great Christmas, thanks to the Newmans in Honolulu, who donated all of these toys for my kids and bicycles and everything. Then we drove to the church in the morning, and I sang in the choir. I was in the choir, and I looked really very angelic when I was singing with the choir. And we had our muumuus on and everything like that. We were Christmas and everything. And then I went to my girlfriend's in Hawaii Kai, took my girls with me, and we had brunch, Christmas brunch. And the cost of Christmas brunch was you have to bring two bottles of champagne with you because we're having mimosas all morning and afternoon. So I brought my two bottles, and we're having mimosas, and which is basically a real pretty word for morning drink, okay? And so I'm having mimosas, and boy, they taste good going down with the orange juice and all that kind of stuff. And I was just, I don't even have any idea how many. The kids were just playing and all that, whatever they were doing. I don't even know what they were doing. But I know that when we left there, probably was around 1, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, maybe 3 o'clock. So it's probably about a good 4 hours of drinking. And I drove my kids back from Waikai back to where I was living in Mo'ili'ili, which was about 15, 17 miles, something like that. And then I saw myself. I woke up in my drunk. I woke up out of my drunk, making coffee to get sobered up at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, so that I could drive out to Wahiwa, where my oldest daughter was living on base with her husband, to see my grandchild. And that was when I had that moment of, oh my God, I'm trying to sober up at 5 o'clock. That means I drove with my kids in the car. I did that thing that I said I'd never do. I couldn't believe that I was doing that. And that was my moment. I even have a picture of me on that day, you know, after I was already sober by that time. And that day really had a big, it really, really had an impact on me. I mean, I was afraid that that was happening. I wasn't really quite sure. But when that happened, that was why New Year's Day got to be my first day sober. And I wasn't really quite sure. I thought, okay, I'm going to give this AA thing a pretty good shot. I'm going to do it for a year. I'm going to do it for a whole year. I'm not going to drink. And I'm going to do whatever they say to do. Because, see, I'd already learned how to take directions in Al-Anon and do the following the steps. And I was already up to almost doing 8 and 9 in that program. And so I thought, you know, one of the things that was in my favor is I learned how to surrender. Because you still have, it's the same 12 steps. You still have to surrender to your power greater than yourself. And I knew by that time who that was for me. And so I thought, well, I'm going to do this for a year. And first of all, if I'm not drinking, there goes all the alcoholic boyfriends. There's no more alcoholic boyfriends for me out there. And so if I'm not drinking, then I'm not hanging out with them. And there goes a lot of the drama. And if all these problems go away and it turns out not to be, there's always that hope, right, that this is all going to straighten up and then I can go back to drinking again, right? There's always that one. And I thought, at the end of the year, I'll figure this out. If I'm not alcoholic, then I can go back and all these problems will have gone away, you know. I mean, and I was in a terrible state. I went to the doctor and the doctor said it was wrong. Well, I had bronchitis. I was working too much. I wasn't, you know, getting proper nourishment. And all the stress, you know, those darn planets, you know, those stars were so on me. And so when I talked to him, I said, you know, I really don't feel good. And he says, well, what's going on? And I said, well, I've lost my business, and I had to give back my car, and I've gotten another job, and doesn't pay very well, and I'm living in a really crappy little neighborhood, and this and this. And I laid out all this litany of stuff that was going on, and he looked at me, and he says, I don't think you think you're depressed. I said, I think I'm depressed. And he says, you really have a lot of depressing stuff going on right now. So he prescribed me something, you know, to for nerves or whatever. And I tried taking it. After about a couple of days, I was like seeing things on the ceiling that weren't really there. And I said, well, there goes that. But before I left the office, I said to him, I said, well, if I start feeling better, how will I know if it's the medicine or if my life is actually getting better? How will I know the difference? You know, because I mean, if I'm taking this stuff and la la la, you know, then must be some good stuff. But you know, how will I know? I mean, I really still had a little bit of a thought about, you know, altered state and all that. So anyway, it didn't work for me anyway, so that was fine. But when I started AA and I started going to the meeting, then they say 90 meetings, 90 days. And I'm going, you've got to be kidding. I've got to work. I've got these kids, blah, 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 blah. Well, there was this one meeting that was in the park. How are we doing on time? Well, shoot, we're running over. Group conscience, can we go over a little bit? Give me 10? 10? Okay, good. And so I went to this meeting that was in the park, Alamona Park. Great big meeting, about 50, 60 people there every time. They had a little karaoke and a couple of speakers, and they made coffee pots over there by the sink. And, you know, this group was such a wild group. It was called Happy Hour Group. Every day, 5 o'clock, they got kicked out of a VFW hall. This group was a wild group. They were pretty wild. And so they had their group had all of their supplies in a car that somebody had donated to the group, and it was all locked up, and the insurance was paid for, and that came out of the, you know, the money, the plate that was, you know, collections and stuff like that. And they kept all of their literature in there and the coffee supplies in there and all of that stuff. And that was an actual meeting, and it's probably still going on to this day. And we met rain or shine every single day. I had my kids playing on the grass over there, and I showed up to that meeting. And I mean, I went 89 days not really sure that I was alcoholic, but somehow I heard my story by somebody that was sharing. And then I knew, without a shadow of a doubt, that I was alcoholic, and I could say it. Because up till that point, I was going, my name is Ann, I have a problem with alcohol. My name is Ann, and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, I got so many snickers and, you know, people laughing at me and all this kind of stuff, you know. And I just thought, well, I'll just hang in there. Because my friend just kept telling me, the only requirement for membership is that you think you have a problem with drinking. That's the only requirement. That one tradition kept me in. because otherwise I wasn't really sure. But after about 89 days, I figured, well, if I didn't have it when I got in here, I must have caught it from the coffee or something, because I'm full-fledged now, you know. And I'm really glad that I stayed in there long enough to find out. And so that was the very bottom. But within about 5 months, I was living back in Hawaii Kai. I had the kids back in the school that they went to. Life just progressively got better and better. You know, one of the things that came up for me was that I'd never gotten my high school diploma. I mean, I'd gotten some kind of an equivalency test, which is what I needed to do for my licensing, but I'd always felt less than. And so right after I got sober, I went and I took the class for the GED, and I got my GED, and my sponsor brought me a lei when I walked across the stage at age 42, graduating high school and getting my diploma. And then after that, I went to college and I started taking classes in business and so forth. But how alcohol can put a person's life on hold, wherever it is, and just keep you right there, I can't even believe it. I mean, it just stopped me in my tracks from progressing, from getting beyond the trauma of my childhood was just still with me. I may have packaged myself different on the outside, but it was always still with me. But this disease and the recovery of this disease is what the remarkable thing is, and that's what I wanted a few extra minutes. I mean, the drinking stories, we all know them, we've all had them. I'm just saying that just to let you know that I qualify for this program, okay? And then I know what you guys are feeling. If you're new in here, I know exactly what you're feeling like. But the recovery part of this is the most important part of this whole story. In the last 19 years, I've had a life. I mean, things have gone really, really well, but it's also gone in correlation to when I'm working the steps and when I'm doing the program right. I went for quite a few years there where I was doing one meeting a week, had a half-assed sponsor, didn't work the steps really rigorously, and never got through those step 9 of the AA program. And I mean, my life just kind of plateaued right there. Then I got into the church real heavily, and I thought church is all I need, because, you know, if I'm going to stay sober, it's going to be because of my spiritual condition, and staying pretty good over here at this nice Baptist church. They don't even drink over there, okay? But I'll tell you something. There's some pretty sick people at church, too, you know? But they'll say, bless her heart, you know? They say that a lot, and we'll pray for her, you know, and stuff like that. But what I realized is that there's a place for everything. And Christianity is my faith that I believe in. That's my God, the God of my understanding. But I couldn't get the Jesus one step. I couldn't, and a lot of people have, and I'm not saying nothing about that. But I had to come into a room with other people that are like me, showing me how to do life and how to remodel yourself for life. And you know, that's what I needed. I needed somebody to show me, how do you have social skills? You know, how do you handle yourself at a funeral? What do you do when such and such happens? What's the appropriate thing to do? I had to learn how to be appropriate. You know, my mother was just like, during my teenage years, she was so sick. She couldn't teach me anything. She was an army officer's daughter. She knew. She could have taught me everything that I needed to know, but I didn't know anything. And so I had to be taught by the people in these rooms, you know, how to act appropriately in life. And I'm still learning things like that. I mean, every time you go through a new situation that you've never gone through sober before, you got to find out from somebody, how do you do this? You know, how do you do that? How do you dress for stuff? You know, I got in, boy, I mean, I was one of the foxiest chicks in the meetings because there might be a cute guy somewhere, you know. I mean, you know, that's what I was, you know, come on, girls, well, you know. You know, because it was always the guy. It was always the guy. Don't have a relationship in the first year of your sobriety. So I had 4. Right? Well, 2 of them were in program. They were best friends till I came along. You know? I mean, you know, you have to learn this stuff. Okay, you have to clean up your act a little bit. You can't be dressing that way and have guys to treat you, you know, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, I mean, women got to get it with the women and show the women how to be ladies again, because we kind of lost that in the bar scene, you know. I mean, we were real good at, you know, getting what we needed out there, you know, getting the attention, which equal to somebody paying for your party, which equal to maybe somebody even having a place for you to crash, which equal to maybe even marrying you or whatever, you know. But as far as girlfriends, they were competition. They weren't. I didn't know how to have a girlfriend. I didn't know how to have a friendship. I didn't trust anybody. You know, my mother was alcoholic, and I couldn't trust her. I mean, there was times when she could have stood up for me, and she didn't. And so I didn't trust women. And then men, I knew how to tool them, but I didn't know how to trust them or like them or anything like that. And I actually learned how to like them. And I learned that, you know, that you actually get back what you put out there. And so if you're not getting good stuff back, you're probably not putting good stuff out there. So, you know, this is all the sobriety, this is the university of being sober and living a recovered life. And recovery is very, very important. And so fast forward, I did get married two more times after I got sober. And, well, the first guy was one of the guys from the first year, which, you know, that's not a good year to be picking people to be with for your lifetime. But, you know, so that one lasted about 2 years of marriage. And then, you know, the police took him away. And then another restraining order. And then I met a guy, and I said, well, no more of that stuff, right? I mean, I'm a sober person now. I need to pick a guy from the church flock out there, you know. And so I got a church guy. He sang in the choir. He went to my Sunday school class. He didn't drink. You know, that's cool. You know, that's everything on my list. And I did everything the right way. And I acted all the right stuff. And it still didn't turn out right. He was sick as could be. I wasn't doing meetings. I didn't have a sponsor. If I'd have run this guy by my sponsor, she would have said, you know, she would have said, you might want to check out this and this and this. That might be, and I saw some yellow flags, but I just, they didn't match up with what I wanted at the time, whatever that was. You know, I eventually did a ninth step with this guy, and I even told him, I said, I didn't come into this thing with the right intentions, and I'm going to be real honest with you about this, and if you want to try to make a go of this, that's fine, but we burned this sucker down to the ground, and we got nothing, and so we'd have to start from scratch if you were interested or willing. You know, he said he was, but his actions said otherwise, and 3 years later, I was divorced from him. But in that time, in those last couple of years, and I was hanging in there because by now, I wanted to do things the right way, and I made this covenant with God, and I was going to stick it out no matter what. No matter what, that's, you know, self-will. I've got lots of will. My sponsor that I was working with those couple of last 3 years were miserable. And I'd gone back into the rooms. I got a really good sponsor. And so she helped me to walk through the fact that she's like, you know, what he's doing is none of your business. What? Yeah, it's stay out of that. What he's doing with his kids is none of your business. You stay out of that too. And, you know, you might not want to say that, and you might want to be a little more light and polite, and, you know, stay in your part. Let's work your stuff. Let's not look at him. Let's not look at the marriage. Let's look at your stuff. And she made me stick with my stuff, and I got through all of my stuff, and I got real clear about, and then I could start taking a look at, you know, if this isn't meant to be, God, then just let it go, you know. So I came home from a beach weekend with the girlfriends, and he was gone. Stuff was packed up, and he was gone because I'd already let him go. And I didn't have anything going on with that. I was letting him go, and I was done with that. And I was real clear that I wasn't gonna do that anymore. I was going to really check in with me and find out what it is that's really going to work for my life and somebody that I want to be with, not somebody I needed to be with, you know. Somebody that wanted to be with me, not somebody that needed to be with me. And so I've been now married for about a year and a half to a really great guy. He treats me like a queen. We have so much fun. And we laugh all the time. We got a couple of new kittens. We're now the Moochie kitten and Mama Daddy. And, you know, we're having a great time. He lives in Cartersville. Bless his heart, I didn't hold it against him. I said, way up in Cartersville? He says, yeah, you know, Red Top Mountain. I said, oh, well, that's not that far. Okay, all right, I'll come up and see you. So anyway, I've been up there in Cartersville now for a couple of two and a half years. And, you know, I love my life today. I'm able to show up. I'm able to show up as a grandmother for my, I've got 6 grandchildren and 3 more from by marriage, and I'm able to show up as a mother of a recovering daughter, my youngest daughter. I didn't go into that, but she's got 2.5 years now in the program, and I'm really, really happy about that. She's my baby daughter, even though she's like going to turn 28 pretty quick. But I'm so happy that she's in the program because she's got 2 beautiful kids, and I get to show up for those kids. I went and got to buy some football uniform equipment. And I don't have nothing. I don't know nothing. I call my husband. We got to go to the sports place, and you got to go with me because I don't know nothing about that. I didn't even know what section to go into to get football stuff, you know. And so anyway, we did that. I get to show up for people that I want to honor that are about the age that my mother would have been had she lived. And I've already outlived her by 11 years. And so far, I'm pretty darn healthy. And it's because I put down the drink. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here today. I'm really sure that I probably would have met with an untimely death. Or eventually the stars would have caught up with me. Or something would have happened, you know. Or my health would have gone, you know. But I'm real healthy, and I work in a shop with all the people in the shop that I work in are half my age, okay? And I run faster and quicker than any of them do. I mean, they look at me and get tired, you know. But that's because I love my life and I love living, and, you know, I stay as healthy as I can. I exercise and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, like on every other Friday, I go to this assisted living, and I get to show up for these sweet people. Some of them can't remember things, but I get to show up for them and, you know, fawn over them, make them pretty and make them laugh and all that kind of stuff. And I get to show up for them. I get to show up for a marriage. I actually get to show up consciously. I'm learning how to be a respectful wife. And all these things came from just being sober and being in the program, being willing to take some simple suggestions from my sponsor. And, you know, I can't sponsor myself. That's the ism. I sponsor myself, right? Get crazy as Fruit Loops if you do that. You know, you have to have somebody outside of you to do a check on you, because it might sound good up in my head, but God, there's a lot of stuff going on up in my head. So I might want to run this by somebody, especially if it's going to be anything that's important, you know, like most of the things in life, you know, and decisions you have to make. And, you know, that's what I need these rooms for. I need my home group to keep me attached, because I used to be very aloof and noncommittal and independent as a hog on ice, as my grandma used to say. And I need to not do that. I need have the accountability that these rooms hold. I mean, church is great. They love you kind of conditionally. You kind of have to fit in to their doctrine and stuff. But there's no accountability at church. None. None whatsoever. They'll just pray for you. They'll see you, blah, 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 blah. Now, you come in these rooms, unconditional love and accountability. They're going to hold your feet to the fire. You say you're going to show up, they make you, you know, you show up. And accountability is in doing the steps. You know, we don't just talk about these things. We actually do those steps. We actually roll our sleeves up and get the work done. I've got sponsees right now, and one of them's here tonight, and I'm really proud of her. But basically, I'm just giving her the same advice and guidance that my sponsor gave me, you know, which is basically you do these steps, and then you'll get to be friends with yourself, and you get to stay sober, and you get to show up for life, and you get to grow. You know, you start learning these traditions, and you start to get along with other people, and you get to learn how to live inside of a group or a family or a marriage. So that all the things that pertain to life are in that book. I was told that over and over again. I'm here to tell you it's absolutely true. I have a life that I never dreamed of because of the sobriety that I have in Alcoholics Anonymous. And with that, I'm going to thank you for listening to my long rambling story.